The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for July the 28th. I'm Alok Char. Coming up, we discuss disease prevention, medical engineering and eye snakes with our special guest, Ted Bianco, the Wellcome Trust's Director of Technology Transfer. Also in the podcast,
I would like to have our oldest and closest ally with us as we return to the moon.
As NASA celebrates its 50th birthday, the agency's administrator, Michael Griffin, shares his thoughts on the British space program. Plus, solar power from Africa, a crackdown on homeopathy, and why Lonesome George may not be feeling so lonesome after all. It's all coming up on Science Weekly from The Guardian. After doing this show for 2 and a bit years and making it the second most popular of The Guardian's podcasts, we've finally been given what's known in the trade as hospitality in the studio. Well done, producer Ben. To the non-media types, that means we've got some tea and biscuits, so forgive us if we occasionally speak with our mouths full. Here with me in the pod is Guardian science correspondent and indeed science daddy, Ian Sample. How are the jammy dodgers, Ian?
I'm just trying to get to them, actually. They look
good, don't they?
That's a chocolate biscuit,
I think. Also enjoying the bourbons and custard creams is our special guest this week, Ted Bianco. He's a professor of parasitology and also currently the Wellcome Trust's Director of Technology Transfer. Ted, thanks for coming in. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about what your job entails. I mean, I see it as people like Ian and me, we write stories all the time about how papers are published. And we say, you know, here's a research paper, here's some discovery, and in 7 or 8 years, researchers expect it's going to be in clinics. You're the person responsible for those 7 or 8 years. What happens in that time?
For 25 years, I was a medical researcher working on pretty basic problems in biomedicine. And I have to say that my current job is the greatest fun in the world, because what I see is the large gap between having a good insight in biology and making that happen in terms of an innovation that can be used for healthcare. So what our job at Technology Transfer at Wellcome is to really help people make that transition, because there are a number of impediments unless people are well prepared and well funded for that step.
I mean, are scientists in general quite good at recognising commercial opportunities, or are they just, is that stereotype of slightly eccentric but not very practical true?
It's absolutely true that serendipity often leads to some of the greatest and most important inventions. That's been true, for example, for the small interfering RNAs, which came out of breeding petunias, then was considered by the people who were looking at the biology of worms and is now considered the main route towards the new therapies, perhaps, of the next century. So we are actually, I think, often not too reliant on our instinct, and we often find that serendipity leads to some of the great discoveries.
So you hold the hands of these professors and things and people like that who come up with discoveries and research papers. Now, give us some examples of what we can expect in the next decade from the kinds of work you're doing at the Wellcome Trust. I mean, how much money do you first of all spend on all of this, and what kinds of areas do you focus on?
Yeah, Wellcome has a big mandate to support basic research in biomedicine, and we spend in the order of £600 million a year. This year we will have spent a little over £60 million on our technology transfer activities, and we expect to be spending at least that, or rather more probably, next year. So this is a growing area, and technology transfer as an activity is around 5 years old at Wellcome. So it's something that we're really keen to explore, and it's because our mission is to foster and promote research with the aim of improving human and animal health. So we need to see tangible outcomes.
So give us some examples. One I picked up on late last year was something called the eye snake. Now, this is what sounds like quite a scary thing. It's a robotic, essentially a robotic keyhole surgery implement.
That's right. The toolkit of the surgeon is changing over time. The saws are being replaced with endoscopes and other devices to be less intrusive. This is a project that was brought forward by Professor Aradhasi at Imperial College, now our very own health minister, working with the engineers at Imperial College in a combined effort to devise an endoscope that draws itself through the body rather like a snake. Now, if you've tried to push a snake by the tail, and I used to keep pythons as a kid, you'll find out this is a really ill-advised...
You used to keep pythons as a kid. We're not going to go into that now, but anyway.
It's a very ill-advised way to push a snake forward. And similarly, when an endoscope enters the body, it creates all sorts of pressures and unhelpful problems in terms of steering and orientation if it isn't manoeuvred from the front. So the intention here is to develop an endoscope which has worm drives that cause the body of the endoscope to be drawn through the body in the manner of a snake, and it will deliver at the site of interest the optics to see what's going on. It will give stabilization of the image to aid the surgeon, and it will allow the surgeon to introduce a variety of devices through a portal down the centre of the endoscope.
So the idea is that the surgery has less effect on the patient themselves. They can recover more quickly, there's fewer scars, etc. And you can do more complex surgery deeper in the body. But tell me what your department has to do then. So Aradhasi comes up with this idea or the concept for it. And then does he build the concept, the prototype before coming to you, or do you build the prototype and then sell it to companies? What happens?
Yes. Generally what happens is that there's support from a number of agencies for working new cutting-edge electronics, engineering and other developments. And there reaches a point where the innovation there is really not helpful unless it's directed to a specific application. If that application is medical, you need the coming together of the clinicians, biologists, and engineers, and that's what we have there. Now, once they've reached a point where the innovation in a device is becoming less exciting to the engineering research boards, they find they're having problem raising funds from that source. It's often at a point where it's not yet attractive enough for the industry to risk heavy investment because there's still a lot of proof of concept to establish. So what we tend to do is we fill the gap between the basic research agenda, whether that's the biology or engineering, and the point at which it's reasonable for a financial return investor to step in, whether that's the industry or the VC community. And so we're gap fillers.
So when does the eye snake turn up in surgeons' hands?
It's likely to be several years before the eye snake is in the surgery. But Aradhasi was one of the leaders in bringing robotic surgery into the UK using technologies which are currently being marketed. So he recognised the need and it's the opportunity provided very early. Now he saw ways to improve the state of the art, and he's got a super team engaged with him. The secret is to integrate the team so you don't produce solutions that are looking for problems. You actually design this in concert between the engineers and the medics.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Ted, one of the other things that the Wellcome Trust is interested in is developing drugs. You've got potential drugs in the pipeline for obesity and TB as well. Can you tell us a bit about those? And then also, I'd like to ask you, how come you're getting involved in that? Why don't you leave it to the pharmaceutical companies who have huge budgets and all of that?
Yeah, great question. Let me begin with TB. TB is a condition that one-third of the whole human population carries as a latent disease. That's 2 billion people. It kills somebody every 15 seconds. So this is a huge problem, and we're losing the battle against TB. Drugs for TB need to be administered over very many months. So what we supported here was a program to develop a vaccine that could be built to work with BCG, the current vaccine for TB prevention, which isn't adequate really to prevent this huge swell of disease that we're seeing. The industry doesn't engage at the early stage in that discovery process because TB vaccines are difficult to develop and the path is long. So what we're doing is de-risking the science by demonstrating, in this case, at the level of a phase 2B trial that will be conducted in southern Africa, where they have an enormous problem with TB. We will try and demonstrate that it is effective, and then we'll see industry engagement.
We'll go through some more examples with you, Ted, a bit later in the show. We'll leave it there for now. Time to move on. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come?
Then you go into a British pharmacy. You do find leaflets badly misinform you about these products.
Ed Zard-Ernst, the UK's only professor of alternative medicine, tells us why high street pharmacies need to be more responsible in selling homeopathic medicines. First, though, here's Ian and producer Ben with a roundup of the rest of the stories making science headlines over the past 7 days.
News Jack. Scientists from the European Commission's Institute for Energy announced an ambitious proposal last week for cutting carbon emissions and alleviating the energy crisis. Arnulf Jäger-Waldau said that turning parts of the Saharan desert into a solar farm and harnessing the power from the desert sun could meet all of Europe's energy needs. It's part of a $35 billion plan to share Europe's renewable energy resources across the continent.
The head of a leading cancer research institute has reignited the controversy over the health risks of using mobile phones. Dr. Ronald Herbermann from the University of Pittsburgh's Cancer Institute sent a warning to over 3,000 of his own staff, advising them to limit the use of the devices because of the cancer risk. His call for action is believed to be the first of its kind from the director of a leading research centre and stands in direct contrast to the existing advice from many health authorities, which have pointed out that evidence of the dangers of mobile phone use is inconclusive.
Lonesome George, the conservation icon of the Galapagos Islands and last surviving tortoise of his kind, may finally become a father after keepers recovered a clutch of eggs from his enclosure. Rangers at Galapagos National Park noticed George had been behaving differently in recent months. They discovered a nest containing 9 eggs, 3 of which they transferred to an incubator. But it'll be 120 days before they're able to confirm whether the eggs are harbouring George's offspring.
And finally, have you ever wondered why pubs turn music up so loud that you have to shout to the person next to you to be heard? Well, the answer may be that canny landlords are using loud music to make you drink up much faster. A study by French scientists suggests loud music in a bar is good for business, and when the volume goes up, punters drink faster and consume more. A team of behavioural scientists found that when the music was up high, men drank an average of 3.4 beers and took 11.5 minutes to knock each back. At a more mellow volume level, the men ordered 2.6 drinks on average and supped for a more leisurely 14.5 minutes.
Let's see if we can unpick a few of those stories. Ian, let's talk about this mobile phones thing. It's a bit confusing, actually, because this is the head of a cancer research institute, so, you know, worth listening to. But he's saying to his own staff, stop using stuff because we don't know enough about mobile phones to know whether they're going to be at risk long term. And, you know, that kind of stuff's also coming out of studies saying that, you know, we don't know the long term risks, but over the short term, at least over a decade, nothing's happening. So can you unpick it for us? What's actually been going on? And there's been no new evidence, as far as I can gather.
No, there isn't. And the only work he was referring to was unpublished. We can't look at it. We don't know, you know, honestly, literally don't know what he's talking about. But look, I mean, this is, it depends how seriously you take the precautionary principle. I mean, he's basically following the same logic William Stewart followed in his independent inquiry in 2000, which didn't find any problems with mobile phones and health, but still he advised that children should limit their time on them because their brains are still developing and such like, as a precautionary principle. I think what Ronald Herbermann's doing is along the same lines. He's saying there are mixed data coming out on the effects, health effects across the board, but he does mention cancers. And why not take a precautionary approach, limit your use on them? And he's going quite strong with children, saying, you know, basically bar them from using them except in emergencies. I totally understand his logic on that. I mean, I'm not a sort of conspiracy theorist or particularly worried about having a mobile phone in my pocket all day long, but I can see his logic.
But the counter evidence to that, I suppose, is that the evidence we do have, if you look at the MTHR studies over the last few years and so on, is pointing in the other direction. I mean, there's nothing to suggest, after all this time, that there is a long-term issue. So, again, it's a judgment call. But this is kind of terrifying, actually, this kind of thing. And you can imagine newspapers leaping on this. So, surely, it's in his responsibility to be a bit more cautious when sort of announcing this stuff.
Well, I think one of the LA Times blogs said, now he's done it. You know, which was the comment on him coming out and saying, putting this memo around. I don't think it's particularly alarming or any particularly scary at all. I mean, I think he's saying, you know, there are studies coming out saying they found mild effects. I mean, you mentioned the MTHR study, which, as you know, because you wrote it, said that, you know, among people who use their mobile phones for more than 10 years, there was a hint of an increase, you know, not hitting statistical significance, so what can we say about it, but of an increase of certain brain cancers and ear cancers. But then Cancer Research UK came out 6 months later with a study saying no increase in brain tumours. So the results are conflicting, but this is the whole problem in trying to find proof of risk of cancer, because, you know, cancer is, you know, more often than not caused by very gradual accumulation of mutations over years, decades. And, you know, these guys have to look at the population for a peak in cancers and then be able to rule out everything else. You can't do that quickly.
Exactly.
It's going to take a long time.
And what causes those mutations can be all sorts of things.
Yeah, and you're going to wait for the study, or he's just saying, look, we don't know, but rather be precautionary
Ted,
down the story later.
What are your thoughts on this? Do you think that precautionary principle is a good idea on mobiles? I mean, are you?
I think it's really important that when we have public messages, people understand how to assess risk. We've had many scares in the past about health that take quite a period to unfold. I can remember back to HIV, when people didn't really understand the basic cause of the immunodeficiency that was showing up on the west coast of the US. We had the same over BSE and many other health scares. It's really important, I think, in communicating the message that people are told authentically what's the state of knowledge, what's the areas where we have deficits in the knowledge and what we're doing about those deficits, so that the nature of the conversation doesn't breach trust. And I think we have had stories in the past where that trust has been breached with the public.
Okay, well, we'll move on to a more positive story. Lonesome George, the tortoise on the Galapagos, probably the one individual, human or animal, other than our mythical British astronaut that we've talked most about in these podcasts over the last 2.5 years. Ian, you're his best friend in this podcast, as far as I can gather. You, the very first few shows, you mentioned Lonesome George.
I did, didn't
and
I?
Yeah, and yeah. It goes on. He's following you.
Yeah.
You don't move very fast, clearly. what's this story?
I think for anyone who's followed this story or even listened to that thing I just read out, will probably be thinking, why are they going to wait 120 days before checking that what's inside the eggs are his, considering he's in a pen with two females and it's only him, and the females haven't been in contact with any other males, and the researchers know this. So the answer is that female tortoises lay eggs pretty much like hens do. They don't have to be fertilized. Female tortoises occasionally just lay eggs, and some of these tortoises have laid eggs before. It doesn't mean they're fertilized at all, so they could just be, you know, empty sort of eggs you buy down the shops. So they will have to accept a bit more turtly, tortoisey. They'll have to check that there are embryos in them, and they will do a DNA test on it as well, because they'll want to know how much of it is the pinta tortoise, which is George, and how much of it is the Isabella hybrid, which are the two females that he's sharing the pen with. And Isabella is the nearby volcanic island where these other ones come from. There have been sights of George mounting females. No one had witnessed him penetrating either of them.
Super. He's an old man who knows what is.
He's an old man. He's between 60 and 70 or 80, but he is still at his sexual prime.
I hope I'm at my sexual prime at that time.
You certainly are now.
okay, well, good stuff. We'll leave that there. If you want to give us your thoughts on any of this stuff, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science, or if you're one of the cool kids, write a comment on our Facebook wall. The merits or otherwise of alternative medicine is one of the bugbears here on Science Weekly, and not just that it can be practiced by a former Serbian warlord. Last week, Britain's leading pharmacists organisation was urged to crack down on high street chemists that sell homeopathic remedies, amid accusations that they're in breach of their own ethical guidelines. Edzard Ernst, the country's only professor of complementary medicine, wrote an open letter to the Royal Pharmaceutical Society. In it, he was critical of pharmacists for selling homeopathic remedies without informing customers that they contain no biologically active agents and are no more effective than sugar pills. Ian spoke to Edzard earlier to find out more.
I've been researching complementary alternative medicine for over 15 years now, and during this time certain things become clearer and certain things have become clear, and I'm fairly certain now that certain remedies, homeopathic remedies, batch flower remedies, aromatherapy oils, are nothing more than a placebo. And perhaps there's nothing wrong with selling placebos, but I just feel a degree of honesty is necessary in all this. And by chance, I stumbled across the ethical code of the pharmacist in this country, and I was amazed to see that they actually have a whole paragraph on alternative medicines that they are selling. So they have thought about it. Pharmacists are intelligent people. They have studied pharmacy, and in the ethical code, they have addressed these problems. And the ethical code is crystal clear about this. A British pharmacist must supply information that is relevant and important. Then you go into a British pharmacy and you find that this is not being dealt with properly. You do find leaflets that badly misinform you about these products.
And let's be clear, you're basically saying that the high street chemists who sell homeopathic medicines without telling people that they contain nothing more than placebo, that they are actually infringing their own ethical code?
Yes, absolutely. They are committing violations of their own ethical code. And I mean, this is serious. This is doctors are being struck off if they violate their ethical code. Depends on how severe the violation is. I'm not saying that pharmacists should be struck off the register, anything like that. But I think the society should give them some sort of guidance. They cannot have it both ways. They cannot pocket the profit that they're making from these remedies and still have in their ethical code that they're highly ethical people. Either they put patients before profit or profit before patients.
Does this really cause any real harm, though? I mean, if someone goes into their chemist and they decide to buy a homeopathic remedy for, I don't know, a cold or for sleeplessness or something like that, they may get some sort of placebo benefit from it, I presume. Do you think there is a actual harm being caused here, potentially?
Sure, there's potential for harm there. We have to realize that a lot of people, perhaps the majority of people who buy homeopathic remedies, batch flower remedies, and other things, go into a pharmacy, and that is where they have the only possible contact with a healthcare professional. They do not tell their doctor, they do not tell any conventional healthcare professional that they're taking these remedies. So this is where they have the possibility of getting some real information. And if they don't get this information, reliable information, then the potential for harm is pretty obvious. They can, for instance, suffer from a serious condition which they treat themselves for a while and therefore lose valuable time. That can cost lives. Only have to think of cancer, for instance. Or these treatments are just simply not effective enough. Placebo effects aren't very large, and the condition, think of a migraine or whatever, remains badly treated, remains untreated, basically.
That chat with Ed Zardernst isn't the only thing that Ian's been up to this week. Now, Ian, you caught up with one of NASA's biggest cheeses, too.
Well, the biggest, the head of NASA, Michael Griffin. Yeah, he was passing through London, dropping in on John Denham, our Secretary of State for Innovation, Universities and Skills, on his way to Farnham Air Show and then carrying on to Paris for a head of space agency's meeting. And he managed to get a nice interview with him in the basement of the US Embassy, nice windowless room surrounded by
guards with guns, maybe.
No, but they all look the same, very square jawed and immaculate, actually, but pleasant. So we got talking, and one of the things obviously I had to ask him about was whether the British government should think about reversing its long-standing opposition to funding human spaceflight.
I do, and I believe that they are considering it, and I've now been over here several times to talk with representatives of the British government who deal with space on exactly that point. I would like to have our oldest and closest ally with us as we return to the moon.
Do you think they're close to changing their mind?
I wouldn't presume to offer an opinion about what Britain will do with its own affairs.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a bit about some of the controversies that come up while you've been head. And the first was you came under a bit of flak for some comments you made on NPR last year about global warming, where you were talking about acknowledging the trend of global warming. But you said, I'm not sure that it's fair to say that it's a problem we must wrestle with. And I just wondered if your views on global warming have changed since you said that.
Well, I'm not going to comment on that. I the problem in making the comments that I made last year was that they are not really germane to NASA's business. NASA's role in climate research is to furnish data about which other people debate. We actually perform our role pretty well, but we don't, because almost all of the data that people use for the debate comes from NASA, and I think that's great. We do a good job. Mm-hmm. But we don't have a policy role in that.
And but as an individual, people will be interested in your own views as head of an agency.
Well, then they'll have to wait until I'm not the administrator of NASA to get my own views.
Just one more, and it was about the obviously a bit of controversy over the fuss over James Hansen. your top climate scientist. How do you think, personally, the situation arose where your press office was evidently censoring your own chief climate scientist?
I don't think they were. I have never accepted the truth of those charges. I and others have dug everywhere they could find to find such evidence. We found one case where an overly enthusiastic young man denied Jim an interview that he wanted to do. On the other hand, Jim has done over 1,400 interviews. So anybody who thinks that NASA is, if they think NASA is trying to suppress Jim Hansen, then I would have to say that also must say that we're doing a terribly poor job of it. Because he's given over 1,400 interviews and frequently testified in front of Congress. I personally am not trying to suppress Jim Hansen. He does great work as a scientist and he's entitled to his own views. I don't agree with all of his views, but he's entitled to them. It's his work as a scientist in furnishing data and models to interpret that data which have been very valuable to the community, and I hope he keeps on doing it.
I was just going to ask you one more finally, and that was that it seems like everybody wants to go into space now. We've got Richard Garriott just announced that he's going. Are you tempted? Have you got any plans?
No, I'm doing what I want to do. I'm helping to shape things for the future. One of many people doing it, but helping to shape things for the future of humans in space, and that's good enough for me.
Would you?
If I could fit it in and somebody offered me the opportunity, sure. But, you know, I there's a lot of things I don't have time to do, and right now that's probably one of them.
You can listen to the full half-hour conversation between Ian and Mike Griffin as this week's Science Extra. Head to the blog or iTunes for more. Now, it's been a while since we've shared your feedback. We're going to start this week with Aidan Synot.
Despite your commendable advocacy of a greater role for women in science, it's noticeable that your science reporters are male and your representative from the arts blog is female. Not only that, but there are constant references to how sexy her voice is, made not only by listeners, but also pod members. What does that tell us? I happen to know more female science writers than male ones. Am I living in a bubble?
Well, Nell isn't here to answer that directly, but we can assure you that she knows more science than any of us saps on a science desk and can't help but have a fantastic voice. Meanwhile, we had a mildly furious comment from Michael Billinger from Canada, who wasn't impressed by our treatment of anthropology in last week's show.
Have none of you ever taken an anthropology course? The questions were just plain simple. I thought that at least someone would be able to come up with the term mandible rather than lower jaw. And then you carried on to discuss complex topics related to fertility and reproduction. Maybe this is a sign that education in anthropology has been lacking. While I'm venting, one more thing. Try to count how many times in a single podcast a member of the pod says, sort of. Language is an extremely important part of science, and the power of explanation relies heavily on precision in language. You know what I'm saying? In it.
Yeah, sort of. Ian, do you think we're dumbing down?
I wasn't here for that particular sort of exchange on anthropology, so I don't know the sort of full extent of what you guys got up to. But, I mean, in terms of he pulls you guys up for using the term lower jaw instead of mandible, and I think I would every time use lower jaw instead of mandible. I know what mandible means, but a lot of people might just prefer lower jaw. It's pretty clear what that means. It doesn't lack any intellectual content.
We said that to Ted earlier. He wasn't sure about that. You're not sure about that, are you, Ted? You'd use mandible, wouldn't you?
I would probably use mandible.
There's a difference.
Why?
Because I know what it means.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, James had something quite interesting to say. He said, we're not dumbing down, we're stupiding up or fooling across or whatever that means. Anyway, the best message we had all week came from a very dedicated listener in Mexico.
Hello, Science Weekly. I've been visiting London this week and tried to see you at the Guardian building, but was not successful. I asked a kind French-accented receptionist for Alok, but seems he was out. Did not occur to me to ask for producer Ben, James Randerson, or Nell Bowes. Do you think there's a chance to visit before the week is over?
Sadly, Francisco, we've been a bit busy this past 7 days, but next time you're in London, Ben will be delighted to take you out for dinner. Ted, let's come back to you for one last time. As well as being head of tech transfer, as we've discussed earlier, your research area is tropical diseases, parasitology. I mean, this is the same sort of thing that Henry Wellcome, the founder of the Trust, was doing. I mean, there's some parallels there. I'm not saying you see yourself as the next Henry Wellcome, but maybe you do. I mean, is that a coincidence? Or
It's no coincidence that, in fact, I was funded by the Wellcome Trust for many years to conduct my research in Trottle medicine, and it came from Henry's real fascination with the tropics. And, in fact, he built a floating laboratory that went up and down the Nile, carrying out research on tropical diseases, which led to him making specific reference in his will to a desire to see the charity address the problems that tropical diseases create. And there's been a strong tradition at the Wellcome Trust ever since in supporting research in that area.
Yeah, and I remember hearing you speaking a few weeks ago at the anniversary of the Wellcome Collection, actually, and you had the most amazing set of anecdotes about bugs, and I'm sorry if that's a bit of dumbing down there, but parasites, bugs, you know. So start reading them off for us, because they were fantastic.
Well, I was turned on to infectious disease, I guess, originally by a biology teacher who had a fairly dry sense of humour, but he sort of scowled at the class and he said, look, you lot, you're only 10% human. And what he was trying to make was a biological point that 9 out of 10 cells in our body are microbial organisms in our gut, helping with our cellulose digestion. They're in our airways, they're on our skin. We have something like 1,407 pathogens that infect humans. And in fact, far from feeling an oddity by being a parasitologist, I feel I'm in the mainstream of biology because, in fact, parasitism is probably the commonest form of making a living on the planet. It's estimated for every host species, there are 4 species that have adapted as parasites to exploit that host. So parasitism's the mainstream.
We shouldn't call it parasitism, then. That's clearly the main way of doing things. And we're just fuel for the real living organisms. Is that right?
Well, you certainly could take that view. People have scowled at parasitology in the past. A former director of the Wellcome Trust said parasitologists are the kind of people that wash their hands before going to the toilet. But I've never been put off by that sort of nonsense, and I think it's really interesting. But I was a failed parasitologist because after 25 years of studying them, I came to admire them for their skill in manipulating the immune system, their skill as physiologists in working with the body, and their skills in adapting over time. And if the scientists who are trying to find new recipes to control infectious disease and organic disease had to be schooled in the same hard knocks of natural selection and evolution as worms and parasites, then we would see, you know, the state of the art rose terrifically.
I think that after 25 years, you just fell in love with parasites that you couldn't bear to come up with ways to kill them. Is that, maybe that's what it was.
That's probably the honest explanation.
Ted, thank you so much. The ticking hands of time have beaten us, though, and to be honest, we've got places to go, so that'll be it for today. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science to find links to all the stories we've discussed and to comment on them. Post a comment there or on the Facebook wall. Thanks to Ian Sample and our special guest, Ted Bianco. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green, but apparently not for much longer. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.